ninth chapter of the Gospel of John, and I've invited Noel Werner and Joyce McKeegan Walker to assist me in the presentation of our text today. Joyce will be reading the words of Jesus. Noel will be reading the words of the man born blind. Hear the word of God. Chapter 9, verse 1. As Jesus walked along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered,
"Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world."
When Jesus had said this, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva and spread the mud on the man's eyes, saying to him,
"Go, wash in the pool of Siloam,"
which means sent. Then the man went and washed and came back able to see. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar began to ask, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some were saying, "It is he." Others were saying, "No, but it is someone like him." He kept saying,
"I am he."
But they kept asking him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered,
"The man called Jesus made mud, spread it on my eyes, and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' Then I went and washed and received my sight."
They said to him, "Where is he?" He said,
"I do not know."
They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also began to ask the man how he had received his sight. And he said to them,
"He put mud in my eyes, and then I washed, and now I see."
Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not observe the Sabbath." Others said, "How can a man who is a sinner perform such signs?" And they were divided. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him? It was your eyes he opened." And the man said,
"He is a prophet."
The Jews did not believe that the man had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but we do not know how it is that he now sees, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that anyone who confessed Jesus to be the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask him." So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind, and they said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." And he answered,
"I don't know whether he is a sinner. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see."
They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them,
"I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?"
Then they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered,
"Here is an astonishing thing. You do not know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but he does listen to one who worships him and obeys his will. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing."
They answered him, "You were born entirely in sins, and are you trying to teach us?" And they drove him out. Jesus heard that they had driven the man out. And when Jesus found the man, Jesus said,
"Do you believe in the Son of Man?"
And the man answered,
"And who is he, sir? Tell me so that I may believe in him."
Jesus said to the man,
"You have seen him, and the one who is speaking is he."
The man said,
"Lord, I believe."
And the man worshiped Jesus. Jesus said,
"I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see, and those who may see become blind."
Some of the Pharisees who were with him heard this and said to him, "Surely we are not blind, are we?" Jesus said to them,
"If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now that you say, 'We see,' your sin remains."
This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
The man blind from birth, who Jesus sees as he walks along, the one whom Jesus heals with spit and dirt, the healed man is perhaps most remembered for saying this, "One thing I know, that I was blind, now I see." But what he says at the end of the chapter is much more important and is the title for the sermon, "Lord, I believe." "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" Jesus asks all the way at the end of that chapter. "Who is he? Tell me that I might believe in him." Jesus tells the man that he is the one. Or in Bible speak, "The one speaking with you is he." "Lord, I believe," is the formerly blind man's strong affirmation of faith. And according to John, he worshiped Jesus. The man said, "Lord, I believe." And John tells us the man worshiped Jesus. The man's most famous line, "One thing I know, I was blind, but now I see." But notice he doesn't say that to Jesus. He says it to the Pharisees. Actually, the man doesn't say much to Jesus. Another one of these long chapters in John, these encounters with Jesus, but this time Jesus and the main character, they don't have much to say to each other. The man doesn't cry out to Jesus to be healed. He doesn't acknowledge Jesus right up front with a title that would imply a faith that precedes healing. In fact, the only thing here in the beginning of the story that Jesus says to the blind man is, "Go and wash in the pool of Siloam." Jesus gives that instruction and then disappears from the page until, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" As became clear in our presentation of the biblical text before you this morning, when it comes to John 9, all of John 9, Jesus says very little. And much of what he says, "He was born blind so that God's work might be revealed in him. I am the light of the world. I came into the world for judgment so that those who do not see may see and those who do see may become blind." Much of what Jesus does say leaves the disciples, the Pharisees, the church, you and me, scratching our collective heads. Clearly, when it comes to the man born blind and the bulk of this story, Jesus has little role to play. Well, he did heal the guy. That's a big deal. But John spends so much time writing about the man born blind and the neighbors and his parents and the Pharisees. The miracle, one presumes, the spit, the mud, the washing, the miracle happened in a blink of an eye. But John goes on and on and on. John goes on and on telling of the man's growing confession and understanding of Jesus. First, he knows nothing. Then, with his sight restored, he makes reference to a man named Jesus and tells the neighbors he had no idea where Jesus was. Then the man tells the Pharisees about the mud, the washing, the seeing. "He is a prophet," the man tells them, as they demand to know what he says about the one who healed him. Then when the disciples call the man now healed a second time, and as things must have started to sink in during the interrogation of him, he says, "If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." And finally, after he had been driven out, Jesus goes after him and finds him, and in that last exchange between the man and Jesus, he confesses faith in the Son of Man. John goes on and on and on to show the man born blind's evolving view of Jesus. And just as his brain must have had to catch up to his newfound ability to see, his heart was gradually catching on to Jesus. The Pharisees' reaction to Jesus healing the blind man moves in the opposite direction. First, they are divided, worried less about the healing, worried more about Jesus working on the Sabbath. Then, "We know that this man is a sinner." And by the end, their exasperation wins out, claiming to have no idea where this man Jesus even comes from. And with his growing sight comes his expanding response to the disciples. With each interrogatory, the man's answers come with more of an attitude. "Do you also want to become one of his disciples?" Until, as John tells it, they reviled him. That's a harsh word. They reviled him, and they drove him out. When you go over and visit the new Princeton University Art Museum, there are some paintings that are best viewed from a bit of a distance. Obviously, that's not unique to the galleries on campus. Any museum, anywhere, some art is best viewed from a distance. One New Testament scholar describes the 9th chapter of the Gospel of John as John's ultimate artistry. John's ultimate artistry. Preachers for more than 50 years have been taught at the seminary down the street to stand close to the biblical text, to use all the tools of biblical historical criticism to examine the text closely, to try to determine authorial intent, dig into the Greek text, find the true meaning. Pastors who identify as biblical textual preachers were taught to invite their listeners into a close reading of the text. In the case of John 9, zero in on Jesus' words, trying to figure out Jesus' intended meaning in the beginning of the chapter and at the end, to dig in and try to get in the heads of the man's parents who were worried about those in power and those who make rules, religious power and religious rules, so worried that they would deny their own son. To stand so close to the text that you find yourself distracted by that first question about sin and blindness and the challenge of translating Jesus' answer. So distracted that this infamous encounter with Jesus and the blind man may just become less meaningful and relevant to those who seek to live the faith. So focused on a close reading of the text that one may, in fact, take away from the ultimate artistry of John's gospel. John invites the reader to take 20, 30, 40 steps back from the artwork and look again. Take a step back, not just for an overview or a summary, like somebody in the office saying, let's keep it at 30,000 feet. No, take a step back, perhaps for a whole other meaning. The man born blind was seeing more and more, and the Pharisees were seeing less and less. The man born blind was seeing more and more, and the Pharisees were seeing less and less. And with Jesus playing the overture and the reprise, Jesus at the beginning and the end, what comes to the fore is the man born blind's interrogation by neighbors, parents, and Pharisees, by pretty much everyone, putting the man on trial. What comes into view is the bombarding cynicism, the barrage of mistrust and questions, and the flat-out trial of the man born blind. The interrogation coming not because of the miracle that gave the man sight, but because of his increasing faith in the Messiah and his growing ability to see the reign of God that Jesus brings and the world that Jesus intends. The world interrogating faith and threatening one's ability to see the reign of God that Jesus brings and the world Jesus intends. The world interrogating faith and threatening one's ability to see the reign of God Jesus brings and the world Jesus intends. I had coffee this week with Kevin Sack. He's a visiting professor of journalism at the university this semester and the author of the highly acclaimed book that I've quoted before, Mother Emmanuel, Two Centuries of Race, Resistance, and Forgiveness in One Charleston Church. Kevin told me of his 10 years of research being part of that congregation and moving to Charleston, South Carolina. He described a bit of what the church is like today. Kevin told me for centuries the church was a neighborhood church where the black community walked to worship on Sunday morning. He said there was only one couple who walked to church now, a retired white couple who live in an expensive condo and became members of the church, the congregation, after the tragedy. He then lamented gentrification and the cost of living in the historic southern city. And I said, you know we're sitting in Princeton, right? According to the Wall Street Journal, 10% of our country's wealthiest people account for 50% of its spending. According to Sports Illustrated, the 5 top college quarterbacks are making from $3 million up to $5.5 million to play quarterback in college. Few things interrogate our faith and threaten our ability to see Jesus more than what the world thinks about money. New York Times opinion writer David French is a Presbyterian who writes about faith often. He's more conservative theologically, a former member of the Presbyterian Church of America. A month or two ago, he wrote that the biggest divide when it comes to faith in politics no longer breaks along the traditional lines of right and left. The primary divide for those who identify as Christian in the public square, he suggests, is between decent and indecent. French goes on to quote the Apostle Paul on the fruits of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. The powers and principalities and leaders of the world bombarding and interrogating faith and an ability to see Jesus with an unrecognizable gospel. Years ago, I was serving at a wine tasting for a fundraiser of Housing Initiatives of Princeton. Happened to be on the street we live. Paul Jeans, the rector of Trinity, and I were participating as pourers at the spring event, at the wine tasting, an odd thing for clergy to do, surely. Sometime after all the whites and early into the reds, one of the guests at the table called me over, not for a fresh pour, but for a comment. I didn't know the person. Paul didn't know the person either, so a member of neither congregation. 30 years I've lived in Princeton, he announced in a loud voice to the whole table. And I've yet to find anyone who believes in the bodily resurrection. Now, there's actually a long and rich debate in theological circles, and I've had many conversations over the years about what on earth resurrection of the body means. I hope it's not this one. But I can tell you that his tone that afternoon didn't reflect a question. And with me standing there with two bottles of wine in my hand and a napkin over my arm, I think the belittling intent was clear. Few things interrogate our faith more than the world's demeaning sneer. Saying, "Lord, I believe," and yearning to see Jesus more and more isn't easy amid the world's relentless interrogation. So come to the table this morning and be refreshed and nourished by Christ himself, who invites you here. Because you and I know that the nourishment isn't just for today. It's so we can rise tomorrow facing a Monday morning saying, "Lord, I believe." And then get up on Tuesday and choosing again to live by God's grace saying, "Lord, I believe." And on Wednesday saying, "Lord, I believe." You can join me on that. "Lord, I believe," Presbyterians. It's hard work. On Wednesday saying, "Lord, I believe," and then heading out to witness to God's love and mercy. And on Thursday praying that you'll be able to see just a bit more of the world Jesus intends, saying, "Lord, I believe." Rising on Friday, allowing the Spirit to remind you that you are a child of God and nothing will separate you from the love of God, saying, "Lord, I believe." Come Saturday, finding a voice to speak for God's justice and a craving to see Jesus just a bit more, saying, "Lord, I believe." Because when it comes to the life of faith and our witness to the gospel and our service to the kingdom, the world's interrogation never stops. The world seeing less and less, and you seeing more and more. "Lord, I believe." Thanks be to God.